thanks for having me to the conference. I've had a really good time. You guys have done a great job. The panels that I went to were good. Went to the bid committees, and congratulations to Phoenix for getting the next ASCII pod. Congratulations to Prescott. Good job. And panel I went to speaker meeting last night was really good. So I'm really, it's a privilege to be here. You know, I'll just share some of my experience. I think when Michael called me, he said, we're going to bill it like the Sword of Spiritual Speaker or something like that. So I was happy when he said that. I was like, all right, we lowered the expectations right off the bat. So if you don't like what you hear, just remember, I'm only here as a Sword of Spiritual Speaker. So also, my sponsor is not present, so it's not a sponsor-approved message. So just take it with a grain of salt. I do have a sponsor. His name is Tim. He's got 25 years. If you don't like what you hear, I can give you his number. His sponsor is Howard. He's got 40. And his sponsor is Bob. And God knows how long he's been sober. Those are my credentials, I guess, if you want to call them that. And my credentials in Alcoholics Anonymous, I guess, are a lot better thoroughbred than my credentials that got me here. You know, although we all have a list of credentials, most people would call it a rap sheet, that get us here. And I've got those. So I'll tell you a little bit about myself and tell you about my experience and kind of the growth that I've seen or experienced in Alcoholics Anonymous, and some of it will be my interpretation of my own experience. But there you have it. So somewhere in the 80s, you know, I know how things get real blurry when you try to think back to your last bit of getting loaded. You know, it's like I was talking to somebody last night, you know, and they were trying to tell me, it was like 2002. No, wait a minute, it was 98. And I'm like, yeah, I get that. I understand, you know. I was talking with a buddy in my home group a few weeks ago, and I was like, God, my time frame is just totally melted down, you know. I've been telling stories that I was here at a particular place in like 88 or 89, and then I just realized I was at this concert that was in a completely different state in 89. So how did that happen? You know, and I just couldn't figure it out. It's like I've been telling the story for 20 years, you know. So I don't know. That's what happens to us, you know. Brain gets fried a little bit. In the 80s, you know, like most of you, I just, from the first drink on, you know, it had a serious effect on me, you know, and at that time, a positive one. You know, I took my first drink and I was like, whew, you know, beautiful. That's all, you know, beautiful. You know, there are a couple of characteristics of alcoholics, and again, this is just my opinion, but most alcoholics that I ever talk to, we have a couple of characteristics that others don't. You know, how many of you can remember your first drink? You know, most non-alcoholics don't remember their first drink, but most alcoholics are like, yeah, I remember that. It was like, woo, you know, or at least the first drink that we took by choice. And so I remember I was at my grandmother's house, and I was kind of I was living with my stepdad, so my dad was coming, you know, and that's a big event for a young kid because I don't see my dad that often. And he pulls up in his old beat-up Porsche 911. You know, I know now looking back that like it's a Porsche 911 that would belong to a drunk, you know, dents all over the place and stuff like that, but it's a Porsche, you know. So he shows up and I get in the car and I'm thinking, Dad, I don't feel that good. I'm kind of like all, you know, I just feel nauseous and stuff like that. And he said, I got a thing just for that, you know. And we stop at the 7-Eleven and get some Michelobes in a bottle, you know. And he said, here, just have one of these. You'll feel better, you know. And I drank one, you know, sipping this, drinking it. And I was like, you know, belch a few times. I'm like, wow, I do feel better. That's amazing. Can I have another one, you know? Yeah, go ahead. You know, so I have another one. And little did I know, you know, that I would go chasing that for the next, you know, decade plus of just that feeling of, yeah, you know, drinking makes me feel better. I mean, that was the association I got right off the bat, you know. Drinking makes me feel better. And I've heard it from the podium stated, you know, that I took a drink and it went down and every cell in my body just lit up, you know. And I get that. I understand that. I believe that. So I went about my business, you know, and really I tried to do the things that I saw other people do for the most part. And you know, whether that was showing up to school or I don't know, just doing what other people do. I never really did get it all that well. But drinking was really the only thing I felt comfortable doing. It was the only thing I looked forward to doing. You know, and so I would show up to school and do these things and this and that. But then I was really just waiting to drink, you know, just waiting for the next opportunity to drink. So things went downhill pretty quick. I got my first job at a grocery store around 16, and that put me around people that were old enough to get alcohol and to drink. We used to have these old intercom systems in the supermarket, you know, where you'd be like, "Hey, clean up on aisle 9. Only we'd have some code for like, "Hey, it's almost 9 o'clock and they're going to close the liquor store down. Let's go get tequila." I mean, of course, that's not what we said, but you know, it was like code Cuervo or something, you know. I don't remember, to be honest with you, but whatever it was like, "Man, let's gather up," you know. So all the baggers and the guy back in the dairy, everything, we're all like emptying money out. "We got enough money for a bottle yet? Come on, man. We need 3 more bucks. And then we'd hang around outside the grocery store and get loaded, you know. I was in Texas at the time, and they had state-run liquor stores, I believe is what they call them. So you had to get your liquor there, and you had to get it by 9. So, but, you know, of course, when you're hanging around with enough alcoholics, you'd never miss 9 o'clock. It's not like a bunch of alcoholics go, "Oh, I just missed it. It's 9:10. You know? I mean, that's not going to happen. At 8 o'clock, we're like, "Come on, man, let's go. Let's just get it taken care of." So that really got me good and going, you know, hanging around my people, you know, just drinking and having a good time. I always just wanted to drink more. I mean, it just didn't matter, you know. I just always wanted to drink more. I mean, almost immediately, you know, I'm 15, 16 years old, and I'm hanging out with the older crew and playing quarters at night, and, you know, coming up with schemes so that I thought I was so bright. Like, somewhere along the line, I kept getting in trouble for not showing up for curfew or something, and somewhere along the line, with my keen intellect, I realized that my parents would look at the light that was on downstairs, and when the light was on, they knew I wasn't home. So they didn't even really have to get out of bed, and they knew I wasn't showing up for curfew. So like any good alcoholic, I thought, "Well, I can fix that. I'll go home, turn off the light, and go back out." So, you know, I managed to pull that off for a while until I actually got busted coming back in at 6 o'clock in the morning or whatever, you know. So, I mean, and that's just how my... that's a microcosm of my drinking, you know. It would start in one place, and then it would just progress and progress and progress. I'd get away with something for a while, and then I wasn't getting away with it so well anymore, and then I wasn't getting away with it so well anymore. You know, so I had a lot of fun, and at the time I thought it was just a lot of fun. I was talking to somebody else this weekend that was talking about when they finally got kicked out of their house, you know, their parents' house at 16 or 17 because they couldn't follow rules, you know, and then that was me. You know, so the last night that I'd stayed at home, they'd already tried a whole bunch of stuff. I give my parents a lot of credit. They tried to be patient, and they tried a lot of things. They tried something that was going on at that time called tough love, where I got home and the doors were locked, and there was a quarter taped to the door with, like, I guess they called it a sponsor's name. You know, like, "Call this guy before you can get back into the house." So, you know, so we had to meet at a Denny's and talk about a new contract to come home. Anybody been through this, or am I just dating myself? Like, okay, all right. So I did that whole deal. And you know, I mean, it's just, you know, whatever ramification for whatever time, you know. It was like, let's just try to get Bryce to follow some rules and be reasonable. And you know, I was like a typical alcoholic where just the drinking was all that really mattered. And I never consciously made that choice. I never said, "Look, I don't care what you're saying to me. I don't care what your rules are. Drinking is all that matters." It's just every single time a decision point came where it was, are you going to go do these things that you've said you were going to do, or are you going to drink? There was never a contemplation about the matter, you know. It was, I was going to go drink. And so I agreed to all these terms to coming back, and of course I didn't keep them. I probably didn't keep them a day or two. And my poor parents, I don't know, you know, they'd try to ground me, but then all grounding meant was I'd grab enough clothes for a few days and take off, you know, and then come back when I ran out of clothes. they were doing the best they could. About high school, I was in my last year of high school, and I know now that like my assistant principal was an alcoholic, a recovered alcoholic, and he was having me come to his. I wasn't showing up to school. Well, I guess that was after I got kicked out. But so I got kicked out of the house. The last day when I got kicked out of the house, what had happened was. That's always a good story when you started out with what had happened was. So what had happened was it was 10 o'clock at night or so, and like I already had plans. We had scored, and excuse me for using other stuff, but we had scored some acid, and I was going to meet a buddy, and we were going to go party, you know. But then I was in trouble at home, and I was trying to keep things under wraps, and they were like, you can't go out tonight. So I made a little note to my buddy and said, "Hey, the acid is in the cigarette cellophane. I'll get out about 10:30 or 11, and I'll see you there." And I dropped the note to him, you know. And so that time comes around 10:30 or 11. I sneak out of the house, hop in the car, phew, go party, have a good time. Woo! Get back about 6 o'clock in the morning, you know. I'm laying in bed. I'm fine. I get like a little bit of sleep, or I'm I don't know. And then my dad comes in about 7:30, throwing boxes at me, and I'm like, "What happened? What did I do?" You know? And it turns out he was out mowing the yard, and I forgot to move the note that said that the acid was in the cigarette cellophane. So I'd gone out and partied and left it on the front seat. I was like, man, really? So that was it, man. I was done. They were done with me, and so they said, "You got to go." And at this time already, you know, I believe I'm 16 years old or 17, maybe just turned 17, and I've already got all kinds of people around me labeling me as an alcoholic. And I never really gave it much thought, or I didn't think what that meant, or I didn't really care, you know, but I just, an alcoholic. you know, my parents were already talking about me having issues, and I had a buddy that was hanging around this lady that said she was a psychic or whatever, and so he was over hanging out with the psychic, and the psychic said, "Hey, how come you didn't bring your alcoholic friend?" You know, so we talked about it afterwards, and I'm like, "That's weird." And then, you know, my buddy John found me a place to stay with this guy named Phil White, and he told Phil White before he moved in, unbeknownst to me, he said, "You know, hey, Bryce is an alcoholic." So, and Phil knew I was only like 16 years old, and he's like, "That dude's not an alcoholic, whatever." And like 2 weeks later, after I'd moved into his house, he came back to John and said, "Man, that dude's an alcoholic." You know. So I mean, the label followed me wherever I went early on, you know. And I started getting into a little bit more trouble with the law, and for me, most of the trouble was just getting drunk and stupid and ending up locked up around it. And most of the time, I just asked for it, to be honest with you. And I don't know why. I would get drunk and I'd have a bad attitude, and you know, stories like, and I won't tell too many, and then I'll move on. But stories like, you know, I remember I was at my apartment. Drinking, just having a good time, and I came across this Budweiser bottle that was actually an Anheuser-Busch bottle. Like it was like the wrong bottle in the 12-pack. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it wasn't a Budweiser bottle; it was an Anheuser-Busch bottle or whatever. And I thought, wow, that's, you know, like for an alcoholic, that's an amazing find. You know, I'm like, wow. You know, I've had so many beers and I've never come across this particular arrangement. You know. This is awesome. So it's like the last beer in the house, and you know the attachment that we have. Again, this is something only alcoholics have. We have that emotional attachment to like the last beer or the last six or the last 12 or whatever it is. You know, so I'm like, I take the beer. I'm just, you know, again, I'm in awe. You know, and I'm just going somewhere where I can just sit and drink this beer and think about how amazing it is that I've found this particular bottle. And so I'm sitting there just drinking the beer and thinking, wow. And a cop pulls up, you know. And I'm like, oh, man. You know, and the cop comes out and tries to be nice to start. You know, he's like, "Hey, you know, you're sitting around, you're underage, sitting out here, and why don't you just pour the beer out, go back up into your apartment?" And I'm like, nah, I can't do that. I'm like, you know, I'm telling him, you know, I'm like, "This is the last beer. I have to drink it. I'm sorry." And I'm like, "Besides, look at the bottle. It's amazing." You know, and so of course that proceeds to where like he's going to arrest me, you know. So he takes the bottle and puts it on top of the cop car and does the whole thing and arrests me. And I'm just like, you know, and And he, you know, he'd given me that choice, and I was just like, no, it's too important to me. You're going to have to arrest me, you know. And, so then he drives off with the bottle on top of the car, and it just and it goes down and breaks. And I gave that cop so much trouble. I was like, you don't understand, you know. That was like a one in a million beer bottle, and look what you did. Besides, it's littering, you know. So, I mean, so that was my relationship with police officers. It really was. I just was not, you know, typically I was not, you know, I just had a bad attitude. And, you know, so those were the kind of things I got into trouble for, you know, and I'd end up spending a few days, and then I'd always get warrants for, like, no insurance and speeding and blah, blah, blah. And then the next, in Texas, the way it worked was the next time you got pulled over when you had those kind of things that you never took care of, which, of course, I never took care of, then you'd end up going to jail, right? So, like, when you knew you had warrants and you saw the cops, you're like, you know? And just typical alcoholic thinking, you know, I never thought, like, I'm going to stop doing those things. You know, in my mind, I was like, man, the next time I get a ticket, I'm going to pay it. And, but it was always, you know, it never happened. It just never happened, you know. And it's sad, you know, because then I got into, like, I figured out, again, the keen intellect at work. I would figure out that if you go in, you could serve time, right? So if I owed $350 on a warrant, but you time served, you get, like, well, I think it was $45 or $35 for a day. But if you got busted late at night, it was like 10 p.m. As long as you got in the part of that first day, then it was like $35 for the first day, and you wake up in the morning and you got another $35 for that day, and then you can take, you know, so that's a full $70 off of your total. And so I'd have that all figured out, and I'd go to the payphone and call and be like, all right, I need $170 to get out of here, you know? And again, the, you know, never thinking that I just needed to avoid those things altogether, but thinking that I had it licked when I had the system worked out, you know? And I went in at 10 p.m. and I was like, yes, I got 2 days, you know? And I also had a really bad habit and of like going to jail, certainly with no shoes. I don't think I ever went to jail with shoes. And a lot of times I didn't go to jail. I went to jail without any clothes except for the clothes that they gave me because, you know, one time, one time I went to jail with shoes and I was just stoked. I was like, yes, I went to jail with shoes because they had that metal grate that you had to walk over outside of your cell and it always hurt your feet, you know? So then I got there, well, I didn't realize it was some kind of like topsiders with a leather strap through it or something. They made me give up my shoes because it had the leather strap through it. Like, oh, man. And, the one time that you know, I would drink and I would get melancholy and then people weren't treating me right. So then I'd go sit in my room and probably drink the last beer or the last whatever. So one night I was doing that and then everybody had upset me. They weren't treating me right. So I went out the window and of my bedroom and I was walking naked down the middle of some road and a cop pulls up and I'm just thinking it's bad luck. You know, it has nothing to do with the fact that I'm walking naked down the middle. It's like, oh man, who'd have thunk that I'd be walking naked down the middle and walk right up on a cop, you know? So then I got down to jail and I had to call my roommates and be like, I'm in jail. And they're like, no, you're not. You're in your room. And I'm like, no, go knock on, you know, go open the door. I'm not in my room. I'm in jail. Really, for real. And so those are the kind of things that luckily, you know, I never ran anybody over. I never, I got involved in a lot of single car accidents. And typically, you know, at that time, I'd just get into single car accidents and I'd be all busted up and people would show up and they'd be like, yeah, you look like you paid the price. And, you know, and that was that. So I moved out of Austin, Texas, where I was from. And I've always said, you know, it was 87 or 88. I don't really know when it was because I was at some concert there in 89, so no clue. So I moved out of there in the late 80s, let's say. I thought that this was going to be the answer, you know. And it did, you know, it got better when I moved straight to Phoenix, and it got better there just because somehow I managed not to get picked up all the time. I managed not to end up in jail all the time and all of that. So that much got better. Everything else about my life got worse. But the time I spent in jail decreased. So that was a good thing. So I moved out here and for like 30 days, everything was, you know, great. And then I found my people, and I was right back to doing what I do on a regular basis. And it actually got worse because I'd never really gotten, oh, yes, I had, never mind. So you know, I just kept running and gunning, and my life just kept going downhill and downhill. I couldn't keep jobs. I was pretty unemployable. All I cared about was drinking. I got a job at Circle K, 16th Street in Oak, and I did the overnight shift there. And you couldn't pay anybody to take that job. You know, I mean, it was a horrific job. There was a place called the Playtime Lounge right next door. And there were just a lot of, you know, my buddy says, seeking lower companionship. And there wasn't a whole lot lower I could go. I mean, my lower companionship, and I was right at home. You know, I belonged there. And I loved it. I thought it was great, you know. So people come in off the streets, and we do, you know, I'd do drugs at the Circle K, and I'd sell vodka for food stamps, because who wouldn't? And but I know it's hard to believe I got fired from that job. And I remember that being a low point. And I remember grabbing a bottle of Seagram 7 off of the shelf as I walked out. Figured, hey, they already fired me, what the hell? And I just remember walking down 16th Street and thinking, what happened to my life, you know? This is the early 90s somewhere, and I knew somewhere along the line I'd gone off the rails. I couldn't figure out where it was, but I knew that my lifetime, you know, goals were not to get fired from the Circle K working graveyard, you know? And I was just really depressed, you know? So I drank for a couple of weeks, because what else are you going to do when you're depressed and you don't have a job? And then I started looking for work, and I got work, and this was my last little, you know, my last run of a few years. I found a job, and I was able to get loaded and stay loaded most of the time and still work, and so that worked out pretty good for me. And it allowed me to progress to the point where I hit my bottom, you know. And so I'd gone to AA a couple of times previous when I was about 18 or 17 or 16, whenever I'd gotten kicked out of the house and did some of that, but I wasn't ready at all. I wasn't paying attention. I wasn't, it wasn't bad enough. I was still just having a good time. I just wanted to get loaded. It had nothing to do with anything else. But finally in 1992, things had just gotten so bad. I'd gotten to the point where I was having a harder time, like even with the job I had that allowed me to kind of stay loaded and hungover all the time and such. I had a hard time getting through the day, and my drinking didn't start there. But I got, and not everybody's drinking has to progress to there, but this is just my story. I got to the point where I'd get up in the morning and go to AM, PM on my way to work and get a half pint of gin with grapefruit juice and a couple of hot dogs. And that was breakfast, you know. And then I'd go to my morning break and I'd have a couple of beers, and I'd go to lunch and I'd have a couple of beers, and I'd go to my afternoon break and I'd have a couple of beers. And that was just to get me through, you know. And then 4 o'clock would roll around, and every day, no matter what was going on, I'd end up at the bar or end up drinking. And in the summer of 92, it was a Saturday. I had gotten paid on Friday, and it was a Saturday morning, and I got 86 from my local bar that it was almost impossible to get kicked out of, you know. And it was 10 o'clock in the morning, and so I decided I was going to go somewhere else, and so I hopped in this $40,000 company van that I was using for work and started meandering my way over to Tempe. And I had officers looking for me in law enforcement because I wasn't driving well. And I got pulled over a couple of blocks from the house. And this is all just a big blur to me. Basically, I can't, you know, have you ever come to with the cops behind you? So I came to with the cops picking me up there at Broadway and rural-ish. And for the first time, I was like, I really became a pathetic loser. Well, at least first time in my recognition, I became a pathetic loser at that time. I'm hanging out there in this little holding cell, and I'm just like, you know, hey, do you have anybody that you can... No, I don't have anybody I can call, you know. Whatever, just put me away, I'm done, you know. And I don't know what the It turns out, and I had no clue. So anyway, they called me a cab, and I went to the bar to look for my wallet, and then I went home, and I drank again the next day, and then I realized that I didn't know where the van was that I was supposed to be responsible for. And so Sunday morning, I got up and I was calling around, and I was like, I didn't know who would pick me up, even to be honest with you. So that's where that fog was in. So I was calling Tempe police, and I said, you know, hey, did you pick me up yesterday? I'm looking for my van. Is it an impound or something? And they said, no, we were looking for you, but we didn't find you. And so they said, why don't you try ASU campus police? And so I called ASU campus police, and they said, oh, yeah, we had you. And so they told me where the van was, and so I went over and got the van. And, you know, typical alcoholic, I went and got the van, and I brought it back to my apartment, and I parked it. And I got out, and here's my best thinking at the time. You know, even as I told you, as pathetic as I felt, as miserable as I was, the best answer I had when I got out of that van was I stood there and I looked at the van and I thought, note to self, remember where you parked the van. You know? Because the best I could do was, I mean, I knew I was going to get loaded. I just didn't want to lose the van again, you know. I had to be to work the next day. So I went out and got loaded and went to work the next day. But the next day, my typical thing was that I would, you know, be really hungover for a couple hours. And then, like I said, about noon at lunchtime, I'd smoke about 12 cigarettes on a 10-minute break and drink a couple of beers. And that would be like my regrouping period, you know. And then after that, I was ready to go. You know, then I'd be like figuring it out for the next day. And at this moment, I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it for the first time. And it wasn't that anything worse had happened. It was the same old crap thousands of times over. But for the first time, again, that clarity was like, this is not, you know, something is wrong here. Really, that was all I had. You know, something is wrong here. I don't know what it is, but something's wrong. And I got in the phone book and made a few calls to treatment centers and stuff. And they'd be like, yeah, we have a 7-day program. Come on down and we'll check you in. And I'm, no thanks. And because I knew something was wrong, but I wasn't sure I wanted to do anything that drastic. So I called the AA hotline, and I was talking with the person on the other end of the hotline, and they said, yeah, there's a meeting right around the corner. They meet at such and such a time. And I said, you know, they said, why don't you go if you want, you know, and if you don't like it, you can leave. And I thought, wow, that is perfect. You know, that's what I'm looking for right there. It's just a place I can go check it out. If I don't like it, I can leave. That's right up my alley. So, I mean, this is, again, just my story. That's how I ended up to Alcoholics Anonymous, is that every other place that I called seemed a little bit too stringent for me. And so I needed that, you know, that tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous, that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, and there's no dues or fees or nothing else. You know, I needed a place where I could just show up. And so that's what I did. I showed up to the Tempe Bloopers, 1935, East Apache, sometime in 92, summer of 92, and I started this journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, and started slow. You know, it was a great group, a bunch of old timers, bunch of new young people. And I knew, I don't know much of anything about those first months coming around or those first days coming around, but I know that I must have felt an attraction. You know, we talk about the attraction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I must have felt an attraction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I must have known I was in the right place, because I came in with the attitude that if I didn't like it, I was going to leave. And I kept coming back. You know, I came to the next meeting, and I came to the next meeting. So something about the people there, something about the message, something about Alcoholics Anonymous brought me back, even though I didn't want to be there. You know? And I really just thought I was going to come and stop the bleeding. But, you know, I just started going to a couple of meetings a day, and nothing made sense to me at the time. I didn't trust the step stuff. It didn't make any sense to me. I didn't really understand that people were truly sober for a period of time. I just didn't get any of that, as most of us come in, and why would we have any experience that understood any of that? You know, the only experience I ever had was getting loaded, and any brief period of time that I had not getting loaded was just time in between drinks. So I didn't have any reason to believe that this would be any different, that this would just be time in between drinks. But I came around long enough to start hearing a few things that made sense to me, and it was stupid things that wouldn't make sense to anybody else at the, you know, but it was what I needed to hear at the time. There was a guy there named Doug at the time, and he was a dude with long hair, looked kind of like a white snake dude or something, I don't know. And but he was a cool dude, and he was sober, you know. And one night after a meeting, he came up and he goes, "Hey, dude, long-haired dudes can get sober too." And I was like, "Yeah, that's deep and heavy, man. Thanks." I mean, that's what I needed, you know. I needed to, because I would never have even considered being sober, you know what I mean? So, and then, like, Jim gave me his card, and I got loaded a couple of brief times after that, but really just, like, would go out and drink and then come back to bloopers. And he'd say stuff like, all you had to do was say no, and I was like, really? You know, again, never occurred to me. You know, and then the next time I came back after drinking, he goes, "You know, I gave you my card. You could have called me before you drank." And I was like, never occurred to me. So it was little things like that, you know. And I was really resistant to the idea that there was any possibility that I could get sober and stay sober. Really resistant. And I just figured it was time in between drinks. But I was going to a Beginners and Slippers meeting at the Bloopers in a trailer. And it was a good mix of some guys that were on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous, guys with 6, 8, 9 years sober, and then a couple of old-timers that had, you know, 20 years sober, and then a bunch of new cats that were there with, like, 4 days and 8 days and 36 days and all that. And they were just sharing their down and dirty experience of how they got sober and what made a difference for them in Alcoholics Anonymous to get sober. And I started hearing some things in that meeting that I needed to hear. You know, and it was also that they were really patient with, belligerent is not really the word, but resistance, you know. And so they'd say, whatever, you know, that might be fine for you guys, but it's not going to work for me, you know. And I can vividly remember, you know, I was a couple of months sober, and I'd just been going to meetings, and I'd you know, drank a couple of times, and I didn't feel any change really within me, you know, other than I wasn't getting loaded. But I felt like the same guy, but I just wasn't getting loaded. And I knew that wasn't going to work. You know, I felt pretty much like I was always just an arm's distance away from a drink, and as soon as I got that close, I was done, you know. And I was at one of those Beginner Slippers meetings, and one of the old guys broke out the forward to the third edition, Jimmy, is that right? Forward to the third edition, and I can never remember which numbers they are, but it's the one where it talks about the fact that that Alcoholics Anonymous has a message that works for people of all cultures and all lifestyles, and doesn't matter where you go, it works. And that it, some places it might be called Los Doce Pasos, and another place it might be called Le Due Tapas, but wherever you go, it's exactly the same steps that were followed by the original people getting sober. You know? And the forward talks about it growing from, you know, a handful of people to hundreds of thousands of people getting sober. And those old guys were saying, so you're going to tell me that hundreds of thousands of people in 90 different countries and all these different cultures and all these different lifestyles can get sober with Alcoholics Anonymous, but you can't. Well, that was my argument until you made it sound stupid. You know? And now I'm certainly not going to use it. You know, and the first time, I guess, maybe of my ego being turned back on itself. But man, I literally remember walking out like a different person or having a different mentality, just walking out of that meeting with like that, you know, that exchange that lasted 2 minutes. And it reminds me of the stuff that's in the book with Bill and Ebby and the melting away of the, you know, because that's what it was. Because I walked away and for the first time in my life, I just had that inkling of maybe. You know, up to that point, it had always been, not going to work for me, not going to work for me, not going to work for me. And I walked out of there going, huh, maybe I can get sober too. Maybe those guys are right. Maybe it might work for me. You know, first time ever. First time ever I ever had hope that maybe I could get sober and stay sober. You know? And so I continued going, you know, continued doing the deal, going to meetings and trying to pick up little pieces here and there and put it together. But it started making a difference. You know, I actually got a sponsor. I wasn't doing the sponsor thing up to that point. I was doing I sponsor myself, the ism part of alcoholism. I was hanging out playing pool with guys, and I had a really difficult time. I'm sure nobody else can relate to this, but I always just wanted to be hip, slick, and cool, you know? And even in Alcoholics Anonymous, I just wanted to be hip, slick, and cool. And so I didn't want to ask for help, and I didn't want to really, you know, I didn't want to be honest with people about anything. I just wanted to be hip, slick, and cool. And it wasn't serving me all that well. And so I got a guy that I had listened to a lot. We're out playing pool one night. It was the hardest thing to ask for your first sponsor. I don't know why, but it was for me at the time anyway. And we're out playing pool, and I'm like, "Hey, Jerry, would you mind hearing him?" And he's like, you know, "What was that? Would you mind sponsoring me, homie?" And so anyway, you know, no big deal. "Oh, yeah, sure, man. Oh, okay." What a load off, you know. And he goes, "Oh, I thought you already had a sponsor." And no, just me. And so we started walking the path together, man, and I love that guy, and I don't talk to him too much anymore. I do see him around occasionally, and he's still sober, but man, he really laid a good foundation for me. He really did. Maybe he did things a little bit differently, again, just my experience, than some. Like, I mean, it was right out of the book and stuff, but he was not a, like, he was, "Let's do it as it is in the book, and then you need to find God, you know? And you need to find what's true for you and start sharing it, you know, and start figuring it out and go on that path of discovery for yourself." And it was in a really gentle way. Sometimes I don't hear that a lot. But I'm just so grateful, because what he did for me was, you know, we spent a lot of time together for a couple of years and then we didn't, you know, but I had that foundation that was necessary to have a relationship with God and to know what to do when I was feeling out of sorts, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I certainly haven't done things perfectly, and I've made a lot of mistakes, but I've always been able to go back to that foundation and get reconnected with Spirit and get back on track, you know. And I'm grateful that it wasn't like that. I wasn't just following Jerry to stay sober, because if I was just following Jerry to stay sober, I'd have been in trouble at some point in time. You know, big things that happened to me after that were, you know, again, it's just taking pieces of things and putting them together and building, a sobriety. We worked on a fourth step together, fourth and fifth step, and I went and shared that experience with him one day on a Saturday, and basically took all day. And again, that was one of those experiences where, you know, just like that previous experience of not having any hope and then having hope, I didn't feel like I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous. That didn't make sense to me. None of it made sense to me. But then I did that fourth and fifth step, and it made, like, I felt a part of. I felt like I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous. I felt like I was doing the work. I just felt completely different, you know? And I didn't feel, like, actually, I felt kind of emotionally, I felt so empty from getting rid of so much stuff that I've been carrying for so long that I actually felt kind of, you know? I was like, "Oh, man, now what? I've gotten rid of a lot of stuff. I've gotten rid of a lot of anger and guilt and shame and remorse and all that. And now I just feel kind of empty, you know?" And that was a good thing, because it needed to be filled with some more positive things that I didn't have at that point. But I just, going, you know, the experience of going to a meeting, even just that particular, that day was different. You know, I was able to walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and feel like I belonged and just feel a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hadn't felt that before. And also feel like maybe I was taking out a little bit of insurance against that next drink, you know, because I was doing some of the work. So that was that experience for me was life-changing. Again, you know, and then I went through a period in my sobriety, which for people around me was probably kind of annoying. And I see a lot of it here, to be honest with you. Not in a negative way, but I think it's critical. I think it's a critical stage, and I share it with guys that I sponsor. And my sponsor hands it down to me. My sponsor says, "You better get on fire for AA in the first 5 years." You know? I'm like, huh. He said, you know, that's what's going to carry you. You know, and it doesn't carry you. Like, I can't stay sober on what I got in the first 5 years, but I can fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I can fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous and being busy and stand believing in this thing, you know. And the only reason I say it was annoying for the people around me is like, you know, I can remember we would do young people meeting outside of Bloopers underneath this canopy. And so now I've done my fourth step. And you know, a little bit of education is dangerous, and so now I've become like, you know, the I guess for lack of a better term, you know, like the 120 day wonder or whatever. You know, I'm like out there with my big book and going like this, you know, it's right there. Can you believe it? You know, and they're like, yeah, we've been saying that. You know, I'm a couple years sober. You know, but I mean, just so that annoying, like, you know, highlighting stuff in the book and going, no, dude, it's right there. And but again, that stuff, you know, the reason it's such a big deal to me, and that's why I think it's a big deal to go through that process, is that you have to understand, I mean, that's a psychic change right there. I just went from, I don't believe this crap is going to work for me, to being so on fire with it and so believing that this stuff is going to work and so believing that this is what it's about. But I mean, that's a complete shift in thinking. You know, if that's not a psychic change, I don't know what is. And I believe if you're going to have long-term sobriety, you have to go through that at some point. You know, you have to go through that, and hopefully the sooner the better. You know, the sooner the better. So that got my feet planted in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And from that day to this, you know, I do try to have that growth, you know, and sometimes I grow steadily, and sometimes I grow haltingly, you know, or don't. And I remember sitting in a meeting one time and saying, you know, the growth just seems so slow. You know, and the guy said, well, at least you're not going in reverse. Like, eh, I got you. That makes sense. So, you know, a lot of beautiful things have happened since I've gotten sober. You know, I've always stayed plugged into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not one of those guys. I've always done meetings, and always sponsored people, and sometimes poorly. And but I've done it. And you know, just stay plugged into Alcoholics. I see people that just, you know, hit occasional meetings or do whatever, and I just, you know, I don't know how they do it. You know, I have to stay plugged into Alcoholics Anonymous and remember what I'm doing and what it's about and where I fall off and what I do that's goofy. And the only place I learn about that stuff is to keep doing it. And I've gone through periods of time because of things that happened with the guys that were sponsoring me, where I've gone periods of time without a sponsor, and those again were not good times, not good times. I sponsor myself, still doesn't work. But the last 5 years, again, I've been sponsored by the same guy and Tim, and he's told me some really, you know, again, simple things. Like right before I asked him to sponsor me, you know, he says, I always have one in my back pocket, you know, the next guy in case something happens. This is the guy that's going to sponsor me, you know. Because he doesn't want to be without. And he also talks about, you know, I want to keep this program of Alcoholics Anonymous healthy for my kids, you know, and because I know, you know, and I now have got a couple of kids, 5 and 8, and, you know, I'm not going to be able to carry the message. I can be a model and an example to my children, but I can't carry the message to my children if they need it. That'll have to be done by somebody else. And so there better be a couple strong groups here and there to do that, you know. And I like what my wife says too. I haven't heard her say it much recently, but she used to say, you know, as long as I'm doing, like if I'm doing what, sticking true to the principles and all that sort of things, then AA is going to be fine. Because that's how it's done, is on an individual basis, you know. On an individual basis, sticking to it, and on a home group basis, keeping your home group, you know, to that. And when you do those things, then, you know, you are responsible. You know, a lot of responsibility pledge being done here this weekend. And if we are responsible individually and as a group for Alcoholics Anonymous will be just fine. You know, and I believe that that is what my responsibility is. And I'm so grateful today to have the sponsor that I have, because he reminds me of what I'm supposed to be doing. And I can always call him and I'll question, you know, hey, Tim, am I doing the right thing here? Is this what I'm supposed to be doing? And yeah, you know. I've got some guys in my life that bounce in and out on a regular basis and just can't seem to get this thing. And I've been really moved by that over the past couple of months. Just the gratitude that I have for the fact that I'm on this side of staying sober and not the other side of staying sober. And because that journey is not a fun one. You know, getting across that line and into sobriety can suck, you know. And I hope that I never have to make that journey again. You know, and it hurts sometimes to see guys having that struggle. And then I'll call Tim and I'll say, Tim, am I doing this guy a disservice? Am I supposed to, you know, tell him to go on down the line and hook up with somebody else or something? And he said, no, just be consistent and keep doing what you're doing. Open up the door, pick up the phone. And that's what I try to do. I try to tell these guys the exact same thing every time I talk to them. You know, and one thing I can say from my heart of hearts and know that I believe it with every cell of my body is that Alcoholics Anonymous works. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous works, and it works for everyone. You absolutely, you know, this ever all inclusive, never exclusive. You can't be left out of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can't. You may be able to keep yourself out, or say that you're not interested in sticking around or staying. But the only people that I've ever seen Alcoholics Anonymous not work for are the people that don't stick or don't stay. You know, if you keep coming around, you come around long enough, Alcoholics Anonymous works. You know, 76 years of history with that, you know. So let's not argue with the results. So that's what I just keep trying to do, be consistent, carry the message. And, you know, and I'm always looking for what am I not doing that I need to be doing to continue to enlarge my spiritual condition. And I'm really slow and not good with that. But I've been starting to take my kids to a little non-denominational church, which seems very congruent with Alcoholics Anonymous because it just talks about the spirit within, you know. And then there's a guy there that's doing some prayer training or something like that, and I thought, wow, that'd be cool to like learn how to pray better, you know. And the training that he was going to do was actually this weekend, so I wasn't able to attend that, but I talked to him last week and I'm like, hey, is there going to be some other time? I'd be really curious in being able to learn more about prayer. And what he was talking about is about affirmative prayer, and it just seems to make so much sense to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's like just to already see the positive things already done, you know, already happening, knowing that just that, again, that principle of I'm always in the right place at the right time, doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing, you know. And I just don't know it sometimes, you know. But if I'm, you know, for a long time, I've been a firm believer of the fact that if I'm trying to do the next right thing and staying sober and showing up to Alcoholics Anonymous, I can't screw it up. You know, I can't screw it up because I'm going to put myself in the right place around the right people to get what I need, you know. And so, you know, it's been an amazing journey, you know, it really has. When I came in with a bad attitude and resentment and resistance, I had no idea that I'd hang around Alcoholics Anonymous as long as I had. You know, I thought I would bandage up the bleeding and be on my way. You know, but I'm just so grateful to be here today and be plugged in with the people that I'm plugged in with and to still, you know, be on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I like hanging out with people that are the same way, you know. And so the one thing I wanted to share before I close, too, is I've heard a lot about, and I'm just sharing, this is my experience coming down from Tim. I've heard a lot of talk about the newcomer this weekend, and that's awesome, you know. And I went to the bid skits, and people were talking about, what are you doing to reach out to the newcomer? And, you know, Tim reminds me that, you know, he says, don't let people fall through the cracks. You know, and you see that everywhere you go. I see that in my own home group. I see that, you know, where we, and like when we did the countdown, and there's those huge gaps, you know. We've got all these people under five, and then it just kind of vanishes for a while. And, you know, and so I'm glad that Tim reminds me to try to not let people fall through the cracks. You know, pick up the phone and say, hey, where you been, man? What are you doing? You know, get over to the meeting. Let's go. You know, and I think you guys have a an awesome opportunity and venue to try and do that, you know, bring in the new people. But the new people, alcohol is going to bring the new people in, you know, they get their butt kicked and they got all kinds of consequences, and they end up in, you know, wherever they end up, and they end up here, you know, because we're out there and we're available, you know. So the newcomers are going to be here, and what we have to do with that is make Alcoholics Anonymous attractive. But I also believe, you know, we got to keep our eyes and ears open for those guys that are here that don't seem to stay, you know, and ask ourselves, what can we be doing to help those people stay? You know, and we know that the answer is sometimes nothing, you know, sometimes nothing, because sometimes they're just not ready and they're not done, you know, and I wasn't done when I wasn't done, you know. But, and that's where I try to talk with all the guys that I hang around with, we just try to be consistent, you know, give the same message over and over and over and over and over again. The truth, the message about Alcoholics Anonymous, that it does work and that it's available and that you can have it. You know, and make sure that that's what they hear. And then if they choose not to stay, then at least what they've heard is it's available, it works, and you can have it. You know, and when they come back again, it's available, it works, and you can have it. You know? It's just been a real blessing to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was really cool to be a part of this meeting, and you guys really have a good thing going in the young people's groups and being on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous and sharing that with others and, you know, being really of service to the community, and I salute you for that. Thanks for letting me share. Okay.